Good evening, everyone, or good morning, or good afternoon, or good middle of the night, depending on where you're coming from. This is the 12th session and last session of our History of Grace Theology class that we've been teaching over the last 3 months, it's actually been, or 4 months. And we are going to be wrapping things up by looking at the contemporary grace movement, and we're going to try to cover as much information as possible. I've got a lot of things. I'm actually just going to teach through this the slides until I get to the end, so I may go over the typical hour that we've had, so if you want to log off at that point, that's fine. But before we begin, I would like to turn it over to a special guest that we have, Dr. Robert Nix. One of the topics that we have on the list, and we'll skip through those slides because he's going to share with us, is the Berean Bible Institute. Dr. Nix is the president of the Berean Bible Institute in Slinger, Wisconsin, and I want him to talk a little bit about the history and in 5 minutes try to share about the ministry of the BBI. So I'm going to turn that over to you at this time, Robert.
Thanks, Don. I just want to share a little bit. Before I do, I just want to thank you for what you've done with this program, because it's, in my mind, a systematic approach that shows that we are not necessarily a recent theology, but we have roots and that go further back. As far as Berean Bible Institute, I, as of March 1st, became the president of the Institute. Just a little bit of background information. In 1995, about 60, and I've heard as many as 70 grace believers met in Menominee Falls, Wisconsin, to pray about a ministry or a training institute that would put out what they believed to be much needed pastors, missionaries, and church workers. And they gathered together and prayed, and it was decided that by 1996 they would start a school. Ed Bedor was coming home from the mission field, Africa. He had been contacted while in Africa and was selected to be the first. It was then called executive director of the mission, or of the school. The school was housed in Berean Bible Society, and you recognize that name because of the searchlight, I'm sure. But the school the society basically did a lot to birth the school. And the school has been in existence for, I think next year they said the 15th graduation, for so around 15 years. And the goal of the school is to maintain a somewhat of a, well, a biblical, a Bible Institute format. Now, what does that mean? It means to be very focused on ministry. And the goal of the school is to not branch out and teach other things. For instance, a college program where you may have a business tract or something like that. It's strictly pastoral, missions minded, and our classes are geared that way. Several months ago, we put together something that we call our four E's. It's to educate men and women in a deeper understanding of the Word of God, with emphasis on what God is doing today in the dispensation of grace, to encourage believers to live by faith surrendered to Jesus Christ, to equip Christians for life and ministry as effective servants of Jesus Christ, and to expose our students to ministry opportunities such as missions, evangelism, and serving in the local church. And that's what we're about. We're a three-year, 98-credit-hour program. Our credits have been accepted by other colleges and institutes. We have a student right now, a graduate of our institute, who went on with some other credits he had accumulated from other schools and is in the Masters of Divinity program at Liberty University. But our goal is to maintain an independent presence. We are not seeking accreditation. We are not seeking to align ourselves with a single group. but we are primarily a training institute with an unapologetic commitment to the Pauline message and training students that not only know the distinctive Pauline message, but also Paul's life, his ministry, his methods, his strategy. So often people look at the message of Paul and they see no baptism, they see church starting in mid-Acts, and that's kind of it, and we're not Israel. Well, all three are true, but the life and ministry of Paul is so broad and so life-changing, and I just feel like we short-sight ourselves if we just keep our theology based on certain key doctrines and get the whole picture of Paul's life. And it's an honor to share with you guys here tonight or this morning or wherever you're at, but just to say thank you for this opportunity, Don, and God bless, and I look forward to listening to the rest of the program.
Is there anyone out there that has any questions for Dr. Nix about the Berean Bible Institute? If you'd like, go ahead right now and you can share if you have any questions. Okay, well, you'll of course have opportunity at the end of the session as well if you have anything that maybe comes up in your head while we're going through this. If you could pull up your slides at this time, this is our 12th session. And there are 43 slides in this, and that's because I'm trying to cover all of the organizations, or at least major organizations associated with the Mid-Acts Grace Dispensational Movement that are going on at this time. So we've got a lot to cover, as well as we're going to look at some very significant history that's taken place in the last 40 years. So we do have a lot to cover. Okay, if you're looking at your slides, you'll see, of course, slide number one, which has the graphic that we've been using throughout our time here. Slide number two says session 12, May 1st, 2011. So we'll go directly to slide number three. One of the things I added in here, just put this in today because it really is an important aspect of our early ministry. If you look at the booklet called Our Grace Heritage, one of the topics that they have is the youth ministry that was one of the first things that was established back when the Grace Gospel Fellowship was formed. The early leaders, and this is sadly been something that in many cases has gone by the wayside over the years as people have gotten older. We have lost that commitment to youth. Not entirely. There are still youth ministries out there, churches with youth pastors, but it doesn't have the same emphasis that it did back in the 1940s. One of the first things that our leaders, J.C. O'Hare and others, had a vision for were youth camps to help to train and prepare young people, give them enthusiasm and inspiration to be involved in the ministry. The first youth camp was organized, actually first talked about in 1944, and the first one was held at McCormick's Creek Park in Indiana, southern Indiana, in 1946, and it was there between 1946 to 1949. The slide doesn't have the dash in there, but it should say 1946 to 1949. Pastor John Levere, who was the founding pastor of the church here in Indianapolis, was the one that organized that camp, and he asked Jack Sonnevelt, who was from the Grand Rapids, Michigan area, Grand Rapids, to become the first camp director. And Jack Sonnevelt became involved in the camp ministry for many years. He went on to be a very successful businessman, and there were a number of very prominent individuals in the Grand Rapids area, Sonnevelts being primarily the primary ones, and a whole large family of them, as well as Baltimore's Veltings and a number of others, who, because of their prominence and their influence, really were instrumental in relocating Grace Bible College, and then along with it, Grace Ministries, Grace Mission, which was Worldwide Grace Testimony, and the Grace Gospel Fellowship, their headquarters, to the Grand Rapids area. But anyway, Jack Sonnevelt was the first camp director of Grace Youth Camp. And then slide number four says the camp moved in 1950, So in 46 to 49, it was in McCormick's Creek, Indiana. Then it went to Western Michigan and was held at a very variety of different locations. In 1966, they purchased the current property in Mears, Michigan, and formed Grace Youth Camp there. And that has grown and developed over the years. Today it's known as Grace Adventures. It's really a first-class operation. You know, I've been there a couple of times, and it's really a big camp, and it's an effective one. The next slide is slide number 5. And this is this talks about another permanent camp that our Grace movement has. In 1954, a pastor from Wisconsin, southern Wisconsin, by the name of Louis Menge, and a businessman by the name of Irwin Cox, his son Doug Cox was the first director of this camp. They purchased property in the town of Gillett, Wisconsin, and they formed Northern Grace Youth Camp for the youth that were from the Illinois, Wisconsin, and Minnesota areas. And so these two permanent camps, youth camps, are continuing to this day. We send our kids in Indianapolis, to Northern Grace Youth Camp in Wisconsin. Grace Adventures usually brings in people primarily from the Western Michigan area. But this was an important early ministry that our leaders found. And then slide number 6 just talks about there are several regional camps as well. Probably, Robert, you were involved in the Southern Grace Youth Camp. I know that was Pastor Roy Lange, who was your pastor as a young man, who was instrumental in keeping that going. There's also a camp in Southern California. There's a very active one in Texas, out of the church in Fort Worth. Also in the Northwest, Washington, Oregon area. So these regional camps, they don't own their own properties like Northern Grace and Grace Adventures, but they rent properties for a week or 2 weeks at a time, have young people going there. So there still is a strong vision for camp ministry and youth ministry. You'll also see a couple of websites there that if you want more information about the camp ministries and their histories or the ministries that they have going on. Slide number 7. We're continuing to talk about the missionary outreach of the Grace Movement. We talked last week about Worldwide Grace Testimony, which was formed in 1939 with missionaries from Africa. And they basically needed to form that mission organization because these missionaries had embraced mid-Acts dispensationalism. They would no longer baptize converts, those that were coming to faith in Christ in those mission areas, and they were cut off. Their support, financial support, was cut off by the mission organizations because of their stand for mid-Acts dispensationalism. And as a result, J.C. O'Hare, being aware of their situation, organized what became Worldwide Grace Testimony, which then eventually became Grace Missions, and then in 1985 was Grace Ministries International. Well, a similar situation was taking place in Minneapolis, Minnesota. The church there was a large church called Bethesda Free Church. It was part of the Evangelical Free Church denomination. And there's a short history that I posted in last week's session that you can go and actually read some of the history of it. And if anybody wants more details, I have actually a full book that I've scanned of their history. But that church was founded, I forget the year, I think it was in the 20s at some time. But they had encountered indebtedness. They had gotten to a point where they were $45,000 in debt. And I think I read somewhere that would have been close to $500,000 in today's standards, or even more than that possibly. But in 1931, the Bethesda Evangelical Free Church called a Minneapolis businessman by the name of H.B. Prince. He was a very dedicated layman, but also a businessman, gifted preacher, to be the pastor of the church. And he came with the stipulation that he would be the pastor of the church if the church would agree to give 50% of all of its income to missions. H.B. Prince was tremendously evangelistic and tremendously missions-minded. He had a real vision for bringing the gospel to the world. And so he said, I'll do this if you'll give 50% of your income to missions. And, of course, the church had this $45,000 debt. So to the business-minded people of that church, this seemed foolishness. Because how, with a $45,000 debt, which was just insurmountable for them at that time, and it was a relatively small congregation, I believe, at that point, how are we ever going to be able to pay for this if this guy wants us to give 50% of the income to missions? And yet, within just a couple of years, they paid off that $45,000, expanded the church, and of course, Robert, you would be able to give us more information about that. Robert was the youth pastor for, how long was it? Almost 10 years were you there in Minneapolis? How long were you there, Robert, if you could just type that? 9.5 years, right. So if I'm saying anything incorrect here, you probably know this history better than I do. Please don't hesitate to correct me. I certainly want to be accurate with my facts here. So, H.B. Prince took over the ministry, and then around 1940, Prince embraced mid-Acts dispensationalism as well. And he encountered a number of problems similar to what the other early men in the movement encountered within the Evangelical Free Church that he was a part of. And because he was teaching particularly the doctrine of one baptism, no water baptism, there was some problems that were involved. Now, there were missionaries that had been sent out from the Bethesda Church in Minneapolis, mostly in Latin America, that embraced mid-Acts teaching as well. And they too were threatened by their mission organization to lose their support. And so as a result of that, the Bethesda Free Church determined that they would actually form within the church their own mission organization. And it became, first it was just part of the Bethesda Church ministry. And so because these missionaries in Latin America, Bolivia, I think primarily it was in Bolivia, were being threatened to lose their support, the Bethesda Church formed a mission organization to support these individuals. Now we're looking at slide number 8, and this is taken actually out of the history of the Bethesda Church. It just says, in 1951, Bethesda gave Oxborough its release to become an independent church. That's not unrelated to this. But it also says, then in 1951, problems arose for Bethesda's missionaries who espoused the dispensational doctrine. Bethesda knew it had to stand behind those missionaries, so it began operating Bethesda Mission through the auspices of the church. And so that was the initial start of what became Bethesda Mission. Then slide number 9, just to give a little background. And I'm sorry I don't have it at the top of my head. I could easily find it, but I don't have the time to go and look for it now. The actual year when Bethesda Mission was released from as a part of the church and became its own independent mission organization, it was sometime in the, I believe it was in the late 50s. So 1951, Bethesda Mission was founded, but it was organizationally part of the church. In the late 50s, it was spun off as its own independent organization. Much of its focus was in Latin America. Bethesda Mission was in Latin America, in the Caribbean, Bolivia, Brazil, and Curaçao, which is in the Caribbean islands, primarily. This is slide number 9. Eventually, Bethesda Mission separated from the church and became an independent mission board. Finley Hunter, Strong Grace pastor who just passed away recently, was the first director of the independent Bethesda Mission, and that was followed by Harry Rossbottom. Harry Rossbottom, who is, I understand he was just in South Africa, he's about 85 years old, and he took sick, as I understand, and they actually had to take him to the hospital, but he went there to participate in some kind of triathlon or something like that at the age of 85. So he's still going strong. as I understand. But Harry Rosbottom served as the director of Bethesda Mission while it was in Minneapolis until it merged in 1985 with Grace Mission. And then Bethesda Mission and Grace Mission together, when they merged it in 85, became known as Grace Ministries International. And so the works, the ministries that GMI have in Latin America are primarily the outreach of Bethesda Mission that was a result of the vision of H.B. Prince, who had this commitment that 50% of their mission, of their church budget, had to go to missions. Slide number 10, we're going to talk about the founding of Things to Come Mission. There were a couple of missionaries by the name of Herbert and Jesse Palmer who had been in Africa, probably in the early 50s, late 40s. They had to return for health reasons, for personal reasons. They settled in Craig, Colorado. Now, Herbert Palmer had a tremendous vision also for evangelism and missions, and so he organized what was called Things to Come Mission. So he was the one. He actually really had an appreciation for Bullinger's periodical. If you remember back when we studied E.W. Bullinger, he was the one who put out the book Things to Come, and that's where the name actually came from, because of the interest that Palmer had in TCM, although I was told by Vernon Anderson that it was also based on the verse of the scripture that speaks about things to come. I can't think of it off the top of my head, but Palmer organized Things to Come Mission, and it was primarily, there were no missionaries at that time for the organization, but he used it as an organization to send out literature, and he sent out literature all over the world, grace, mid-acts, dispensational literature. Some of the literature that he sent went to the Philippines. And sometime around 1957, he sent literature to a group of Protestant lay leaders in the Philippines. The most prominent was a man by the name of Juan Undag. And if you look at slide number 11, you'll see a picture of the original first contacts in 1957 that were the first Filipino individuals. The man, let's see, if you look at the front row, the third from the left, that is Juan Undag. And the second from the left, sitting down, is his brother, Potenciano Undag. And Potenciano Undag and Poten was what they called him. And Vernon Anderson were tremendous. They were a tremendous evangelistic team. Vernon would fly all over in his plane, and Poten would preach, and Vernon would preach, and Poten would translate. And they just went all over the Philippines for many, many years, planting churches, preaching the gospel, and there was a tremendous harvest of souls between those two. So if you're looking at slide number 11, you're seeing the original Filipino contacts that Vernon Anderson went to meet. Now, at the same time that Herbert Palmer was forming Things to Come Mission, Vernon Anderson, Joe Watkins, and their wives went to Milwaukee Bible Institute. And it was there that they became challenged for missionary activity. And they had a desire to go someplace beside Africa, because at that time the only organization was Worldwide Grace Testimony, and they didn't have a vision for any place outside of Africa. They were told flat out that WGT worked in Africa, and Vernon, and especially Vernon, had this vision to go someplace else. And they actually had not determined on the Philippines. They ended up in the Philippines by mistake. But originally they were going to go to the tribes of South America. They were inspired by the missionaries, the new tribes missionaries that were killed in South Africa, Nate Saint and Jim Elliott and the others. And so that they were inspired to go down there, but that didn't work out. And then Vernon had a burden to go to India. And so they, while they were students at Milwaukee Bible Institute, they actually formed an organization called Hope Mission, H-O-P-E, Hope for People Everywhere Mission. But they were told by the people, they were told by the leaders, and Charles Baker was one of them, that they, as students, could not have their own mission organization. And so they were forced to abandon it. Some of the original members of that, of the board of that, and these guys were kids, you know, talking about guys in their 20s. They were just kind of, you know, upstarts and young turts. It was Vernon Anderson, Joe Watkins, Dave Noble, Roy Kelsey was the first board of this Hope Mission. Charles Baker told them, if you keep this mission going, you're going to be kicked out of the school, because they saw that as a threat to WGT. Well, the other three, Hope Mission just kind of was left to die on the vine, so to speak. The other three, Watkins, Noble, and Kelsey, stayed in school, but Vernon left. And he went there with this burning desire to go to the mission field. He connected with Herbert Palmer from Craig, Colorado, and he became, Vernon and Darlene became the first missionaries with Things to Come Mission. And then they eventually left, and they went on a boat to, they actually were planning to go to India. But Herbert Palmer had these contacts in the Philippines, and so he said to them, before you go to India, will you stop in the Philippines and just meet these individuals and encourage them? So they bought their ticket, intending to go all the way to India, bought a ticket on a boat, leaving from Los Angeles in 1958. They arrived in Manila, was met by Poten and Juan Undag there, and basically stayed there for the next 13 years. A year later, they were joined by Joe and Pauline Watkins, and now if you could look at slide number 12, you'll see pictures of the Andersons and the Watkins back in their early days. So in January 1958, the Andersons arrived. Vernon started preaching, and they were planting churches, and then they saw the need for a Bible Institute. Vernon wrote back to his friend Joe Watkins and said, we need help here to start a Bible Institute. So Joe and Pauline, at that time they didn't have any children, they got on a boat at some point in 1958, traveled 21 days over the ocean, arrived in December of 1958, and that was how the ministry of Things to Come Mission was first established in the Philippines. So eventually there were other missionaries that joined them. There was the Bigelows, Vernon and Pat Bigelow, Orville Hunt was a missionary, John Shriver. All of them spent some time in the Philippines. Then a little bit later on came Bill and Eunice Heath, Dan and Jennifer Sidebottom. Susan and myself were missionaries there from 1986 until 1998. Another missionary family there was Dan Gross. So there were a number that came and went over the years, but that was how the ministry began in the Philippines. Then if we could go to slide number 13, we see that there's a list of the nations where TCM has ministries going on right now. 13 nations at this time: the Philippines, Brazil, Indonesia, Kenya, Cameroon, Thailand, Cambodia, Turkey, South Africa, the U.S., England, Uganda, and they hope very soon to begin in Laos. Now, at the same time that Vernon and Darlene went to the Philippines, there was also a contact made by Herbert Palmer, an individual by the name of Henrique Schmidt in Brazil. He was of German descent, of which there are many in southern Brazil, and he had embraced Mid-Acts doctrine, and he began a ministry there. And so the ministry in southern Brazil was actually begun through the contact of Henrique Schmidt. He has a son, Carlos Schmidt, who is actually still ministering with Things to Come Mission, and the Gomer and Nini and Dino are working in that part of the country right now as well. Now, the ministry in northern Brazil, that actually came as a result of Doug and Vicky Lefebvre, who had been missionaries with Bethesda Mission. And then when Bethesda formed with GMI, there was some conflict about style of management that didn't jive between the Lefebvres and GMI, and so Doug and Vicky Lefebvre left GMI, joined TCM, and so that ministry that they have going in Recife, Brazil, and where the Joe and Michelle Campos have been ministering, that actually came as a result of from the contacts that were originally made through Bethesda Mission. Then moving right along, We're going to talk about a ministry that is near and dear to my heart, that up until actually yesterday, I was the director of Prison Mission Association. And I don't know how many of you know, I just recently resigned. I took a job, a full-time job with the state of Indiana, and so have had to resign my role as a director of PMA. I still am the pastor of Grace Church. But in 1955, a man by the name of Joe Mason, an individual who was saved while he was really kind of living like a hobo riding the rails. He heard an evangelist in California in 1923, came to the Lord, and through many years just was committed and dedicated to ministry, sharing the gospel anywhere he could. At the time, he was living in a place called Weatherford, Texas. And he came to a mid-axe understanding of the gospel by wandering into a church in Mineral Wells, Texas, that was pastored by a man by the name of, the pastor in Mineral Wells, his name has skipped me for a moment, but easy enough to find. If you go to the PMA website, you can actually see the history of PMA. But he came into the grace message. He came to understand how mid-axe dispensationalism could answer questions that he had been given by prisoners. He was, at the time, he had a jail ministry in that part of Texas and would travel around from jail to jail. When he came to understand the grace message, then that just completely transformed his life. He founded a ministry of correspondence lessons that eventually developed into, in 1955, Prison Mission Association. Joe was also just a prolific letter writer. He would write to everyone and anyone, and he would share with them the gospel and share with them about the ministry of the grace of God. By the way, the pastor in Mineral Wells, Texas is R.B. Shiflett, who led Joe Mason into an understanding of mid-axe dispensationalism. Slide number 15. Joe, besides having his correspondence ministry all around the world his correspondence ministry in prisons, he had a correspondence ministry all around the world, and he would write to people in prison and out of prison, and he made contacts in Kenya, South Africa, and Cameroon, among other places, India, Thailand, a number of other places. But the ministries that are going on with GMI and with Things to Come Mission in these African countries of Kenya, South Africa, and Cameroon were because of initial contacts that were made by Joe Mason and his letter-writing ministry. He just was enthusiastic about sharing with anyone in any way that he could about this wonderful message of the grace of God. Slide number 16, continuing the history of Prison Mission Association. In 1992, the offices of PMA moved to Port Orchard, Washington, where they are today. They had been in Southern California, Riverside, California, and Vernon Bigelow became the director of the mission, and he was that until around 1990 92 is when it moved. He was there until, I think, probably around 1995, 96, he was the director. Then he passed away. Nathan Whittem became the director until the year 2000, and then 2001 until, as I said, just yesterday, I was the director of PMA. PMA's ministry is primarily sending mid-axe dispensational correspondence lessons to inmates all around the country. We also have our lessons online where people can download them, and I know a number of people are using them for personal ministries that they have or personal Bible study. You can learn more about PMA also at the website that's there, pmabcf.org. Now if you'll go to slide number 17, we're going to talk about the beginning of the Berean Bible Fellowship. And this is a significant event, the forming of the BBF, because it marked the first real dramatic division that developed within our grace movement. J.C. O'Hare was a strong leader, strong individual, good organizer, brought together these various pastors, was able to keep the mission, or the, I should say, keep the movement, in a sense, unified. because he was such a strong individual. Well, he passed off the scene in 1958, and then problems, some of them were related to personality differences and conflicts that arose. Some of them were just differences of opinion on how the ministry should go. But from 1958, really, until around when the Berean Bible Fellowship was formed, these divisions got stronger. We talked a little bit about it last week, in which when Jack Dean became more and more prominent in leadership at Grace Bible College and eventually became the president of Grace Bible College. His background was not in Bible or theology, his advanced degrees, but it was in secular psychology. Cornelius Stamm, of course, was a product of the modernist fundamentalist controversies of the 1920s. And he was raised in that environment of conflict between modernism and fundamentalism. And as Jack Dean was coming and introducing a broader perspective, and especially secular psychology, this was really, C.R. Stamm and those that were close to him, it really bothered them a lot. And if you go to the web page that I provided for them, you can read a brochure that was written in 1979 that recounts the history of why the BBF felt, why they felt they needed to separate and form a different organization from the Grace Gospel Fellowship, which at that time the only real organized group was the Grace Gospel Fellowship. 1967, things reached a head. And led by C.R. Stamm, there was a group of individuals that broke away because of their differences, primarily over the direction that Grace Bible College was going and the GGF, and they formed what became known as the Berean Bible Fellowship, which was, just reading the on slide 17, certain more conservative members of the GGF, led by C.R. Stamm, believed that there was a tendency towards modernism and compromise with contemporary culture, specifically neo-evangelicalism and secular psychology. So if you would now look at slide number 18, the Berean Bible Fellowship was really formed as, and this term I think is very descriptive of them, anti-denominational. They wanted to be very adamant that they were not a denomination, because so many of the leaders came out of denominational churches that had really treated them poorly. In many cases, they had confiscated their church buildings. Some cases, they may have had been entitled to retirement pay and things like that that was not given to them. And so the conflicts that came out of the denominational structure were very, very strong in the early Grace movement, including the GGF, but it was especially prominent in the BBF. And so this group separated in 1967, a significant part of the Grace movement at that time. Its emphasis since that time has always been a strong dogmatic emphasis on the distinctives of mid-Acts dispensationalism. Since 1968, and I believe that's correct, I hope that's correct, there has been an annual Bible conference held at Cedar Lake, Indiana. It's a very historic conference grounds there that was used at the height of the Bible conference movement in the early 1900s. Cedar Lake, it's a beautiful location. R.A. Torrey was a preacher there. It may have even included Schofield and Moody and some of these other men, but it was a historic conference site. Still to this day, the BBF has conferences there every June. It's been going on continuously, dedicated to the preaching and the teaching of mid-Acts dispensationalism. Number 19, in 1987, there was a major split in the BBF because of the influence of the King James only teaching of Richard Jordan, of which we're going to talk about in greater detail in just a minute. Richard Jordan then became the who had been the president of the Berean Bible Society, and was there was that until the 1980s or in the early 1980s, and then Ivan Bergener served as the president of the BBF for a number of years, but at some point in the mid-2000s, and I can't remember the exact year, he actually was forced out because he had developed an interpretation, an allegorical understanding of the rich man and Lazarus, and then eventually my understanding and Steve, you might be able to correct me on this if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that Ivan has gone in and embraced the doctrine of soul sleep. And it started with his interpretation of the rich man and Lazarus story in Luke, I believe it's chapter 16. Then slide number 20, just finishing up on the BBF, is that membership of the BBF has, for many years, there's been a number of controversial histories. Oh, and he's even gone into Acts 28, I'm seeing here. Okay, so it's even gone farther than that. But slide number 20, membership of the BBF has been embroiled in doctrinal controversy many times over its history, and my understanding that there's even a division that's going on right now that I don't fully understand all the details associated with it, but it has that's been a characteristic of it. The current BBF board, however, and this is a recent communication I had from Dick Ware, who is the president, it really wants to become more of a positive-oriented organization, one that is positively preaching the grace movement. It doesn't want to be known as a reactionary group, that they were formed against something. That was their history, but they really want to move in a more positive direction. Okay, slide number 21. As I said, in 1987, there was a split in the BBF, and this came as a result of an individual who was very prominent at that time by the name of Richard Jordan. Some details here. Richard Jordan, slide number 21, was a native of Mobile, Alabama. My understanding is that he trusted Christ when he was in junior high through the ministry of Roy Lange, which is the same church that Dr. Nix came out of, and a number of people. Pastor Lange really had a tremendous ministry over, 50 or 60 years that he was in the ministry there in Mobile, Alabama. But one of his one of the people that he led to the Lord and discipled was Richard Jordan as a young man. And then also, Richard Jordan studied under Peter Ruckman, who is an abrasive Bible teacher that is in Pensacola, Florida. He has a Bible Institute. He is known for his adamant stand on the King James Bible, but I've read a few things that he's written. He's just very, very abrasive, to say the least, in his style of teaching. But that's probably where Jordan embraced the strong teaching about the King James Bible, the idea that it's the perfectly preserved Word of God that cannot be altered for the English-speaking people. And if you will go again to the website, you'll find a letter that I wrote to him, and the reason that I became involved in this whole controversy was because of my ministry in the Philippines. When I was in the Philippines, a protege of Richard Jordan by the name of Dan Gross was accepted as a missionary with Things to Come Mission. And he ministered there for 6 years. We were co-workers there. It was during that time that some of those doctrines, the King James only, and then what they called grace life doctrines, which essentially are doctrines that say that after the conclusion of the scriptures, God essentially withdrew every and all direct intervention in the world today. In other words, there is no physical intervention of God, so there's no point in praying for physical things, praying for supply, praying for safety, these kinds of things, and a variety of other things. That spiritual gifts were completely eliminated after the completion of the scriptures. There are no spiritual gifts that are active in the church today. These are what you might call grace life doctrines that Richard Jordan embraced and taught. Even though he's primarily known in the grace movement for his teaching about the King James Bible. Well, anyway, Dan Gross and I had some very strong conflict. And at one point in our ministry, he challenged me because I had heard the rumors about things that had transpired with Richard Jordan while he was the president of the Berean Bible Society. And so Dan challenged me, why don't you talk to him? Why don't you ask him directly if these things are true? We were together at a Bible conference that was held in Indianapolis in May of 2000, and Dan Gross was there, and I talked to him privately, and you'll see this in the letter, and again, he reminded me of what he had said about 7 or 8 years prior to that I need to talk with him directly. So I wrote this letter having researched, I talked to the people that were involved in this, I researched it, and I wrote the letter, which described the events, and I asked Mr. Jordan, will you deny or confirm these things? Are these stories true? Well, he never acknowledged the letter, having received it in 2000, and then in recent email conversations, he told me that the letter is full of error. So you can read the words for yourself there. He has never explained what the specific errors were, what was inaccurate about it, but the information is there, and I would encourage you, and I would actually very, very much encourage you, contact him directly and see if he will respond. I have never gotten a response from him to outline what is wrong. But anyway, slide number 22, going on about the history of Richard Jordan. He was a pastor in Selma, Alabama, where he held to a very strong view of the King James Bible, what's typically known as the King James only position regarding the English Bible. He came into contact with C.R. Stamm in the early 1980s and made an impression with Mr. Stamm, so to the point that he was hired as the president of the Berean Bible Society. By the way, it is 9:15, and this is the time I normally wrap up, but because we have so much information to cover and this is our last session, I'm just going to keep on going. If you want to stay in the room, you're welcome to stay. If you want to leave, you're welcome to leave. But I want to just finish up all this material since this is our last session. He became the president of the Berean Bible Society. And then if you'll move on to slide number 20, the next one would be slide number 23. He began a training program. Mr. Jordan began a training program in the offices of the Berean Bible Society, which at that time were in Chicago, Illinois. And he was teaching his views of the King James only position. And they became controversial because, of course, they had wide implications. That there was no point in using the Greek language because the translation was already perfect. There was no need to correct it. It had implications for missions because, well, what about other translations? There were just wide-ranging problems that were associated with this that people disagreed with. And so it began to cause a controversy among the constituents of the BBS as well as with the Berean Bible Fellowship, which was closely aligned with the Berean Bible Society at that time. Slide number 24. The doctrinal controversy eventually led to his termination and a split in the BBF. And again, the details of that can be read at the website, what went on. And I would, again, encourage anyone to contact Mr. Jordan directly because he insists that that letter is full of inaccuracies, yet I don't know specifically what they are. And I myself would like to know what the truth is. During his time with the BBS, he became the pastor of the Shorewood Bible Church. Now, the Shorewood Bible Church was the remnant of the North Shore Church that of which J.C. O'Hare had been the pastor. North Shore, the neighborhood around that church began to change, and so they moved away from there, and they combined two churches. One was called Norwood and North Shore, and it became known as Shorewood Bible Church. And it was in a different location from the North Shore Church, but the congregation what was left of the congregation of the North Shore Church basically moved to Shorewood, and Richard Jordan, because he was the president of the BBS, was able to become the pastor of that church. That church has since relocated to, I believe they have a new location, they've relocated, and Mr. Jordan is still the pastor of that church. Slide number 25. The classes that he was holding in the BBS, these classes were videotaped, and they eventually developed into what came to be known as the Grace School of the Bible, which is an extension Bible school that he put together. It has a curriculum for training pastors, training church leaders. And it's been very effective, and that is one thing I will say about the ministry that Mr. Jordan has, is that his training program has reached a lot of people. He has these videotapes, and I believe now they're on DVD, that he sends out. People take the classes, they take the tests and write the papers and everything, and then after going through the set curriculum, and you can do it at your own pace, you can do it in 2 or 3 years, you can do it in 10 years if you want, then they graduate you and you have the Of course, because they have no denominational structure, there's no qualifications to say that you're qualified to be a pastor. They just say that you are now equipped to teach the Word of God. But anyway, the Grace School of the Bible came out of these classes that he had developed in the Berean Bible Society. Slide number 26. Since that point, since the split that took place in 1987, Richard Jordan has gone on to have an essentially independent ministry. And it's been very successful. But he has continued to embrace doctrines that many within the mainstream of the Grace movement have found problematic. Primarily, the number one being the King James only, and then the others being the Grace Life doctrines, and Grace Life is a euphemism for God's intervention has been withdrawn in the age of grace and everything that implies. And it's rather extensive, really, if you want to understand all of the implications of it. But it's the idea that the age of grace is a purely spiritual time. God has withdrawn physical intervention. The idea of the believer confessing his sin is because of our position in Christ, that we have no need for confession of sin. It's just very, very broad. There's a lot of implications with these teachings that he has. So the Grace Movement now has split in yet another direction, and there is what the term that I use is Jordanite. They certainly wouldn't use that. They would call themselves Grace Life believers or whatever. But it's developed, gone into another direction. It's taken on a life of its own in many ways. Not a lot of interaction. Most of the established Grace churches, they already have their feelers up. If they hear anything that would give them any indication that somebody coming into their congregation is teaching Grace Life ideas or King James only ideas, they usually stop it right in its tracks. Most of the pastors are aware and have an understanding of what to look for when they see these things coming. So the Jordanite movement or the Grace Life movement, as I said, has taken on a life of its own. Not a lot of interaction between the mainline Grace movement and the other movement, which, and this is significant to point out, is that the division between the Berean Bible Fellowship, the BBF, and the GGF, that is diminishing. Because, in essence, the problems, the differences that existed were, I will use the word superficial. Some people may not say that, but they were not doctrinal. They were matters of, they had to do with the amount of interaction and engagement that we as Christians would have with the culture and with greater evangelicalism. The BBF at that time in 1967 wanted to remain very separatistic and isolated in a sense, and to have a very strong focus on mid-acts dispensationalism and the uniqueness of it. The GGF was more inclusive, if you would see it that way. But doctrinally, there was no difference. And so now we're seeing 40 years later of these groups beginning to come together because the doctrinal differences were essentially not there. However, when Richard Jordan and his group split off, these were significant differences. There are doctrinal divisions that are not going to be compatible, whether it is the idea of the Bible and the King James only Bible, or if it's these Grace Life doctrines in which they are going to chastise you if you try to pray about spiritual things. They're just not compatible. And so this is a division that as long as people are holding to these views, they're never going to reconcile. And so it is a distinctive movement that is going to take on a life of its own. Slide number 27. Just to summarize, in my opinion, and this is my opinion, what were the influences that Richard Jordan's movement has had to the Greater Grace Movement? First of all, it's created a significant division. As I said, while in 40 years the divisions between the BBF and the GGF and those organizations and entities that are associated with the two are diminishing, and you're seeing a growing together and a mutual appreciation for one another, this will not happen with the Jordanite movement because their doctrines are distinctive. They're different. They had, and this is a positive element, they have a strong emphasis on distance education, the training of lay people. However, another thing that I have noticed as I've listened to the teachers, and I've done, not that I'm an expert in any way, but I listen in, I read the things that I see posted, and I look at their websites, they have developed, there's a need for novelty mindset among them. In other words, everybody's got to have a doctrine that's somehow unique. The movement is amorphous. Although Richard Jordan does have some strong influence, there's still just a lot of independent people moving in different directions, and all of them are trying to develop some kind of teaching that's going to set them apart from somebody else. And so you have this need for novelty that has developed through this, and you see it popping up, and you've seen divisions among them because of these different things. So that's another element of the strong influence of, he brought in novelty when he brought in the King James only and he brought in the Grace Life doctrines. And you know, there's a sense in which grace teaching is a novelty from greater evangelicalism, and so people that were intrigued by our mid-Acts position can never be satisfied sometimes. They have to have something that's always different, always new. To me, the grace teaching is the grace teaching, and I don't see, you know, there hasn't been a whole lot that's been taught in the last 40 years that I have seen a need to change, but some people are always looking for something new. The need for novelty. And then he was the first of the independent itinerant leaders that would develop a distinctive following. We're going to look at a couple of other of these, Les Feldick, Bob Enyart, a few others. Joel Fink is another personality that's kind of gaining a following around their personality and their unique teachings. Richard Jordan was the first. There were others that tried. There were a number that went into Acts 28, a number that tried, but because of the strong cohesiveness of the movement at that time, with the strong personality of J.C. O'Hare and then C.R. Stamm, Charles Baker, while they were on the scene, it was hard for anybody to really be able to pull a large segment to follow them. However, with the passing of those strong leaders, divisions that came, this idea of independent itinerant leaders and teachers with following, you know, personality driven movements, mini movements, so to speak, has increased over the years. And Richard Jordan really instituted a highly effective use of the internet and media. That's something that I've really appreciated about them, and I wish the wider grace movement had taken more of advantage of it. This whole Pal Talk thing, it was the Jordanites that were the first that were onto this, and they're not so much as strong now as they were 5 years ago, where they had, you know, 5 or 10 rooms were open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, preaching mid-Acts dispensationalism along with their other ideas. Slide number 28. I'm going to start going through this now a little bit quicker, but we're going to talk about some, and if anybody has questions, just type them. We'll talk about them at the end. Most likely this is somebody has some opinions about these things, so I would I'm not afraid to bring on conversation. But the next organization I'd like to look at is Bible Doctrines to Live By. It was founded in 1981 by evangelist Lee Homoke, and he had been a pastor first in Tip City, Ohio, and then he went to Evansville, Indiana. While he was in Tip City, he embraced mid-Acts dispensationalism, and so then he moved on. And became the pastor of the Berean Bible Church of Evansville, Indiana, which was one of the major grace churches at the time. Pastor Otis Wasson had been a very influential and strong pastor. It had been a large church in its day. And, of course, Evansville was, that's where Herman Rich was, and the First Church of the Fundamentals was where the first formative meeting of the GGF took place back in 1944. Slide number 29, talking about Bible Doctrines to Live By. Pastor Homoke left the pastorate to establish a full-time ministry of itinerant evangelism and publishing of mid-Acts literature. He moved his ministry and organized it, incorporated it in Grand Rapids, Michigan. In 1993, and I believe that was the year, sometime around there, Bible Doctrines to Live By sponsored the first Grace Revival for Evangelism, which is something that has gone on every 2 years for, since 1993. They have another one coming up this year. And it's a large conference that's tried to be all-inclusive of all aspects of the grace movement. And that's one thing that has always been Lee's burden and vision. He's always tried to be, as it says here in slide 29, an impartial, independent voice of the grace message, not closely aligned with any of the segments, but he's tried to be a force that could bring people together. How successful that's been in the long run, it's hard to say. And perhaps to some extent he has ignored differences that were significant. And again, I'm specifically saying the doctrinal divisions that, Richard Jordan's movement has embraced. But that really has been his vision, is to be all-inclusive. Slide number 30. In the mid-2000s, and again, I'm not sure of the exact year, Joel McGarvey, who had been a pastor in Altoona, Pennsylvania, succeeded Lee Homoke as the director of BDTLB, Bible Doctrines to Live By. And then in the late 2000s, Lee began a ministry, youth ministry called Cowboy Camps, which he continues to this day. And for more information about Bible Doctrines, you can see the web address there. Slide number 31 is another organization, a small mission organization that was started in 1986 primarily as the missionary arm of the Berean Bible Fellowship, and it's known as Word of Grace Mission. Three missionary families, Warren Kuyper, Leo Kuyper, and Bernardo Krasmeyer, and Bernardo's wife is actually the daughter of Warren Kuyper, so they were related. All three of these families were related to one another. They had been missionaries with Things to Come Mission in southern Brazil. But Things to Come Mission never took an official position aligning itself with the Berean Bible Fellowship. These three families had a much stronger affinity with the BBF, and they felt that TCM should have a closer association with the BBF and renounce, in a sense, their association with the GGF. And so because of their strong feelings in that way at that time, they left Things to Come Mission, and the BBF helped organize what came to be known as Word of Grace Mission, which is going on to this day in southern Brazil. If you will look now at slide number 32, the mission continues. Those three families are there, and another young family, a son of the Krasmeyers, are also working in southern Brazil. They have some churches there, they have regular conferences, and they are continuing their ministry. And for more information about them, you can see the web address, wordofgracemission.org. Slide number 33. We're at, and this is another ministry that is active. This has been something that I've had a great interest in. Tony and Barb Sestelos are personal friends of mine, and Tony has put together, he has a real knack for digital media, and in 2002, they had been former missionaries as well to TCM. Barb came to the Lord through the ministry of the Kuypers. She was an exchange student from Ohio who went down there as a high school student. The Kuypers led her to the Lord and discipled her in grace teaching. And then the same year, 1986, that we became missionaries, Sue and I, Barb also became a missionary, went to Brazil. When she was down there working with Doug Lefebvre, she met her husband-to-be, Tony. They were married, served as missionaries for a number of years, and then came back to the States. Tony, as I said, has a real vision for taking literature and disseminating it using digital technology. The next slide. They put together what's called the Grace Online Library, which is a CD that they distribute and sell that has over 250 books on it from various Grace authors. You can find dispensational theology, you can say real baptism, I mean, you name it, any of the most important significant things that differ, all of them are on this CD. And if you don't have that, I would encourage you to contact TBS Ministries at that website and make sure you get a copy of the Grace Online Library, because it's a valuable resource. So that's another ministry of the Grace that's in our Grace movement. Slide number 35, and I can go over this a little bit faster because it is, we've already discussed that with Dr. Nix, but this is the Berean Bible Institute, founded in 1996 with the cooperation of the Berean Bible Fellowship and the Berean Bible Society as a training institute modeled after the Milwaukee Bible Institute. It was originally in the BBS, Berean Bible Society facilities. in Germantown, Wisconsin. Ed Bedore was the first president. At some point in the mid-2000s, and maybe, Robert, maybe you know the date on this, they were able to purchase a very large facility, a former Lutheran church, and convert it into the campus in Slinger, Wisconsin, into the campus of the Berean Bible Institute. And so that's where it is. It's located right now, which is, I don't know, 10 or 15 miles from Germantown. It's all, they're all in relatively the same area. And it has been graduating pastors now, as we found out, for 15 years, who are going into the ministry as pastors, missionaries, Christian workers. Slide number 37, Dr. Robert Nix became the president in 2011, and there is a web address as well to learn more about the Berean Bible Institute. Slide number 38, very briefly, another ministry that has begun since 2005 is the St. Louis Theological Seminary, St. Louis Bible Fellowship, which was one of the early Grace churches. Pastor Eugene Ruhler was the founder of that back in the probably the 30s. I don't know exactly what year St. Louis Bibleship was followed, but the current pastor is Pastor Rick Owsley. He had a desire to start a graduate program for the ministry that focused on mid-acts dispensationalism, and he began in 2005 the St. Louis Bible St. Louis Theological Seminary, which operates under the auspices and in the facilities of the St. Louis Bible Fellowship. It offers undergraduate and graduate ministries, and there is a web address there for more information about that ministry. Another important, very important ministry in the Grace Movement, for a number of reasons, is Les Feldick Ministries. This is slide number 39. Les Feldick is an Oklahoma rancher, very common, ordinary person, who's held Bible studies and Bible classes for over 30 years. He has begun and has had for a number of years a very extensive television, internet, and printing ministry that's been going on. He teaches mid-acts dispensationalism. He is very independent from the rest of the Grace Movement, but there are a number of people within our Grace Movement that have embraced his teaching. They've listened to him on the TV, watched him on TV, found him on the internet, read his books. He teaches clearly mid-acts dispensationalism, but he's always and has maintained a very independent perspective. And in that case, he's not really been part of the larger Grace Movement. He's brought a lot of people into an understanding of mid-acts dispensationalism, but because of his independence, he's not been real effective in informing churches or really in the development of the movement as a cohesive unit. It's really been just scattered individuals that have embraced the message and have kind of been left orphaned here and there. But he does have a good, effective ministry, and has a large and wide outreach. It cannot deny it. And then slide number 40, another individual very similar to Feldick, probably not as extensive a ministry, but this Bob Enyart has another emphasis. He's really primarily known as a controversial conservative talk show personality. He has radio broadcasts that are broadcast in different parts of the U.S., and he's on the internet. I don't know all of Bob Enyart's story, but he came under the influence of one of the old-time Grace believers, who is Bob Hill. Bob Hill is in Derby, which is near Denver, Colorado, and he had started a Bible school himself called Derby School of the Bible, which graduated a number of pastors, and there's actually a very flourishing Grace movement of Derby School of the Bible graduates in the Denver area. I think there are 8 churches, many of whom are pastored by graduates of this school. The thing about Bob Hill was that he embraced what is known as open theism, and that's the idea that God is not fully omniscient in the classic understanding of that term. They will use the term omniscient, but they don't understand it the same way we do. They'll say God knows everything that can be known, but because the future has not taken place, God does not know the future. This is open theism. Those that have come under the influence of Bob Hill, including those churches there in the Denver area, all the pastors adhere to open theism. Bob Enyart is one who also does. He also is a mid-axis dispensationalist. He is known, however, primarily for he is very conservative and is very militant against abortion, against homosexuality, he's a very strong proponent of the death penalty. He's very involved politically. And people are drawn to him because of his political statements that he makes, and they appreciate and they like those things, although I would say he goes a lot over the edge. I think his rhetoric and the way he deals with it is not appropriate, but nonetheless, that's my opinion. But he is also a mid-axis dispensationalist, and as people get to know his ministry a little bit more and read some of his theological writings, then they come to embrace mid-axis dispensationalism. And he has a book out there that's called The Plot, which is an interesting, intriguing title that basically is talking about it develops mid-axis dispensational ideas. So Bob Enyart is another influential figure, along with Les Feldick, who's out there really bringing people into the grace message, but they tend to remain isolated individual believers here and there. Okay, now as we close our study of mid-axis dispensationalism, the history of grace theology, I'm just going to make a few. These are my personal observations. What does the future hold for the grace movement? And this is from my observation. I'm no expert, but I have been observing the grace movement now for over 25 years. Been involved with various churches and the ministries and these kinds of things. And here's the way I see our movement heading. Slide number 41. I believe that there's going to continue to be a disintegration of centralized organization. That the GGF, the BBF, and even Richard Jordan, not that he's an organization, but he's somewhat of a cohesive influence in his movement, they're all going to lose influence. People are going to become more and more independent, isolated, and as a result, and this is a sad thing, but I believe we're going to see churches continue to decline. What we're going to see is an increase in individual believers following personalities, people such as Richard Jordan, such as Bob Enyart, Les Feldick, Terry McLean, another individual who's out there who has his following around him. You're going to see an increase in that and unfortunately a decline in the strength of local churches. You're also going to see the internet as a driving force in the dissemination of the doctrines. Websites galore, chat rooms, all the ways in which we can disseminate this idea is getting out there, and the internet is going to be a very important element in that. And so that's why I would really encourage the mainline grace movement, because right now this has been embraced by the somewhat fringe groups, the Jordanites and some of the others that are associated with that. They're the ones that have really been able to capitalize on the power of the internet to get this out. So I want to say to our mainline grace believers, we need to be going in this direction further and further. Internet will be a driving force in the dissemination of the doctrines. The doctrines are going to resonate less with, this is generally among the culture, with postmodern ideas. Dispensationalism demands a strong logical basis of thinking. Postmodernism defies logic. It says it's often described as not either or, but both and. And so when people embrace that kind of thinking and that kind of mindset, the postmodern mentality, and they're going to see less and less of this Israel and the church, the various dispensations, contradictions in the word, you know, Jesus says this, Paul says this, when those don't resonate, those differences don't resonate in their heart and mind, they're not going to have as much reason to want to embrace this doctrine to reconcile those problems, because postmodernists don't see a problem with that. Slide number 42. You're going to see an increase of atypical non-traditional paradigms. One thing, for example, my daughter goes to a church which is KJV only, but has very contemporary worship. Usually you associate the KJV only position with very old, traditional, stuffy kinds of situations. That's not the case here. This is a very lively, vibrant, modern, contemporary music church, but they hold to a KJV-only position. You're going to see some of these kinds of out-of-the-box paradigms developing more and more as people are embracing from the internet and from all different sources. I believe that it's parachurch organizations, specifically the mission organizations like TCM, GMI, those that have a wider influence around the grace movement, they're going to be the ones that are going to maintain the unity. As the specific organizations like the GGF, BBF are losing influence, the unity among the movement is going to be maintained through the parachurch organizations, as missionaries go from church to church to church to raise support, but they also create that sense of unity and cohesiveness. And then you're also going to see that the growth within our movement, while there will be growth, I think, from among individuals and people accepting it here and there, isolated believers, the great growth is going to take place outside of the U.S., particularly in Asia and Africa, through the mission organizations and the mission outreaches that we have. This is where we're going to see the growth in the grace movement primarily, especially in organized churches. And then finally, 43, the last slide, again, looking at what I believe might be the future of the grace movement. There will be an increase in bivocational pastors. Smaller churches, as we have, are not going to be able to support the needs financially of pastors. And so people are going to have to look for work besides that of full-time ministry. Local Bible studies, itinerant speakers will supplant churches. You're going to see, I believe that you're going to see less churches being formed. You're going to see more cell groups, small little Bible studies, and then the less of the traditional conferences. The BBF, the GGF both have an annual conference. I don't know that we're going to see those things growing or getting stronger. I believe we may see them declining, but you're going to see people, like when Les Feldick comes, 400 people will attend to listen to him. Bob Enyart, same kind of thing. 200-300 people will come and listen to him. Richard Jordan, same kind of thing. Not associated with many speakers, but personality-driven events are going to be on the increase. Training will be distance education-driven. There will be less formal institutions, more informal training. And I believe another thing, in a negative sense, you're going to see pet doctrines. As people try to get influence, try to gain a hearing, everybody's going to come up with a pet doctrine that they're going to try to draw people in with. So anyway, that concludes our 12-week study of grace theology. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. I have done my best to try to present a non-biased and objective explanation of how we came to where we are as a movement. As I said earlier, and as Dr. Nix had said, even though the formalization of our doctrine is rather recent, we have roots that go all the way back to the Apostle Paul, and because of various incidences in church history have not been able to be expressed the way they should, but that we do have historical roots that go all the way back to the time of Paul. Are there any questions or any comments, anything? Okay, Jim says, why did the three that left TCM create Word of Grace Mission as feeling closer to the BBF than GGF when those two organizations were basically the same doctrinally? Well, because there was a feeling among those that were closer to the BBF that the GGF had drifted away. First of all, in terms of emphasis, I don't know that there were ever accusations. There may have been, but it wasn't real strong, that there were accusations that the GGF denied grace doctrine, but that they were too willing to embrace broader evangelicalism, so that they did not have a strong emphasis on the mid-Acts dispensational truth. And the families that formed the Word of Grace Mission felt very strongly in the emphasis of our mid-axis distinctives and truths. And they felt that TCM was, they weren't, you know, going in one direction or the other. They were trying to walk the line, which has always been TCM's position. They have never wanted to be officially aligned with one group or the other. Now, actually, their position is more, we would like to be aligned with all, because I think we're seeing that umbrella widening. But Word of Grace Mission was found basically because even though the doctrine was the same, there was an uneasiness about the lack of emphasis within the GGF-oriented churches and organizations towards the importance of the emphasis of mid-Acts dispensationalism. Any other questions? Okay, Jim, hopefully that answered your question. And if anybody wants to speak, you can raise your hand and I'll release the microphone. Give everybody a few more minutes. I don't want anybody to go away without having their questions answered. Again, thank you very much. I appreciate everybody's... Okay, the two positives of the future of the Grace Movement as you see it were, one, growth in Asia, and two, use of the Internet. Yes. David, yeah, my stand on the King James Bible. Now I'm giving you a personal opinion, and we're drifting away, and I don't want to get into that because I didn't want this to be a doctrinal issue, but I'll just give you my personal stand. I believe that the text from which the... King James Bible was translated, the Textus Receptus, the majority text, actually is the most accurate. I believe it's closer to the originals than the newer texts or the newly discovered texts that even are older. So I believe in the majority text being the most accurate, but I don't believe that the King James is a very fine translation, but I don't believe that it is in any way perfectly preserved. And likewise, especially in my work with prisoners, the Old English is just very, very hard for people to understand that don't have a lot of education, even educated people, because it's not the way we speak. So in our church, we use the New King James Bible because I believe it recognizes the accuracy of the majority text, while at the same time modernizes the language to make it more understandable for our for modern day speakers. So that's again, that's my personal view on that. Any other questions? Okay. It's almost 10 o'clock. I have to get. Oh, okay, Steve. I'm going to give you the mic. Go ahead.
A brief history of the St. Louis Theological Seminary that Rick started, because I was there the day he started it. Because when I was newly saved, every week I would keep asking that man for something to read. So he would give me Things That Differ, so on and so forth. So one day him and my father-in-law, Ed, got together and the school started. There was four of us.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I'm glad to have personal testimony about things that in this. Any other questions or comments? Again, I want to give everyone an opportunity to share. This will be our last opportunity. You'll get one more email telling you that this has been put online. After that, that'll be the end of it. You don't have to get those annoying emails from me anymore. So, but thank you so much for everybody's participation, for your interest, for your politeness and your graciousness. And this will be on my website probably by tomorrow. Do I have contact with Kurt Christ? He's another one of these itinerant Bible teachers, independent Bible teachers. I do not have direct contact with him. I'm familiar with him. I've talked to a number of people that have been influenced by his teaching. So I am familiar with him, but do not have direct contact with him.